This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
If the trucks don't come every single night bringing more food, what will happen in one of those giant cities? If the trucks are prevented by a fuel crisis or a local war or something, you will have starvation within a week in those giant cities.
What kind of fringe alarmist warns us about the coming global famine? Actually, he's one of the big voices from Australia. Julian Cribb has published over 7,000 articles and written or edited 8 books. He's won 32 awards as a journalist and held prestigious positions in several institutions. He's an influential Australian, to say the least. Julian Cribb, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
You've had an eye on agriculture for many years. Last spring, you warned of a developing crisis in the food supply. Was that because of the drought in the best farming regions of Australia, or was it a larger picture that pushed you?
It was the larger picture that pushed me. I mean, as you say, I've been watching what's been going on in agriculture worldwide, and I've been aware for many years that we haven't been reinvesting in agricultural science and technology like we used to do in the 1970s. I mean, basically, the world population has doubled since that time, but our emphasis on agricultural science has dwindled. That was worrying me. But then I began to look at the other factors, like, you know, have we got enough water? Have we got enough land? What are we going to do when oil becomes scarce or very expensive? And when you start to put it together, it becomes clear that feeding the human species through this huge peak in numbers and demand of the mid-century is going to be a very challenging thing indeed.
Population growth does seem central to your argument. I heard your speech as a podcast from the University of Melbourne, and you talked about projections of 9 to 12 billion people. And, you know, my inner voice resisted that. I think, well, that'll never happen. Some disease or war will stop it. But I think maybe we all have a denial mechanism for population, just like we do for climate change. We don't want it to happen, so we think it won't. Do you run into that?
Yes. I mean, people are reluctant to understand the realities of population growth. But, you know, it's not just the realities of population growth. It's the fact that every single one of us, when we open our mouths and put food in them, we are eating vastly more energy, more water, more resources than we ever ate before in human history. So if the world food demand is going to double, but that is partly due to population growth, but it's also partly due to the absolutely uncontrolled demand for food that we have in our fast-growing economies.
We're all eating more, and of course, many of the people of the world now want to eat more meat, and that requires a lot more resources. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Absolutely, and the fact that we're trashing half our food. I mean, in America, in Australia, in Europe, and so on, half the food goes straight in the garbage. So we're producing a lot of food that we're not eating at all. So yes, we're eating far more, and hence you've got a global pandemic of obesity. And of course, you've got China and India exploring the delights of meat and dairy produce and so on for the first time, and they are of course ramping up their demand for protein-rich foods.
It's important to note that you're predicting regional famines and wars. Maybe other places will continue to feed their populations. Where would the food hotspots be?
Well, I think that the crisis areas are going to be mainly on the Indo-Gangetic Plains and the North China Plain, possibly also in Central Asia and the Middle East, and possibly also in North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa. Those are the areas most likely to run out of food and to experience severe local famines. But the point about the book is to say that nobody in the world is going to be untouched by this, because we've already seen just this year how a drought in Russia caused corn prices to soar in the United States and affect prices for food in supermarkets. Everybody is going to be touched, at least in terms of the cost of food, by this. And of course, if there are refugee crises with refugees flooding all over the world and major conflicts arising, then we get affected that way too. So we need to be concerned about it. Famine is not something that happens in a faraway country and can't touch us any longer. It can touch us in very real ways.
Well, I'm really glad you brought that up. I mean, the United States is currently, they have 40 million people receiving food stamp aid, and the doctors are saying we're eating badly and subsisting on fat and sugar. And when you add in the rapidly increasing costs at the grocery store, I wonder, maybe a hidden famine is already developing, even in some allegedly wealthy countries. What would your thoughts on that be?
Well, there's certainly a great deal of inequity about food distribution, even in wealthy countries like the United States and Australia. Difficult problem to fix, of course. The thing we need to worry about, if there was a major famine breakout in Asia, for example, and food prices in the United States doubled, probably half the US population would be unable to afford it. So you would then see a very real impact on ordinary sort of middle-class Americans. So that's the kind of thing we need to worry about. It's the kind of thing we need to think about preventing. And it's caused primarily by the fact that, you know, we're stealing from farmers the things that they need to produce food. We're taking away their water. We're taking away their land. Oil is going to become very scarce over the next 10 years or so. Fertilizer is running out worldwide. It's going to take a while to run out, but it's running out. It's finite. We haven't invested in agricultural science like we should have done. The climate is changing, and that's making agricultural production much more unstable, more prone to drought and so on. And, of course, the oceans are running out of fish. So you add all these things together, you know, you start to see the scale of the problem that we're up against.
Yeah, fish is very important to the food chain for more than just eating the fish, which a lot of people do depend on, but also it's being used as a feed for animal stocks around the world, and we may run out of them, as you say.
Well, currently we eat about 100 million tons of wild-caught fish a year, and that's been stagnant for the last decade. We are not going to be able to double the fish catch from the oceans at the same time as world food demand doubles. So whatever happens, we're going to have to find 100 million tons more protein from land. Now, 100 million tons of protein means you're going to have to grow a billion tons of grain. And to grow a billion tons of grain, you need to discover one more North America. But you add to that the fact that meat consumption is rising worldwide in China and India, as we've discussed. FAO says we're going to increase meat consumption by 185 million tons. Well, that basically means that we would need to find three more North Americas in order to produce all of that protein by the mid part of this century using current techniques. So you can see that's just a way of putting in perspective the size of the challenge that we're up against. We've got to basically triple world protein production.
And a lot of this is in your book. Tell us about the title and what the book is about.
Well, I call it The Coming Famine, the World Food Crisis, and what we can do to avoid it. And my take on it is that it's a world famine because no matter where it breaks out, and it's going to break out many times in the next 50 years, it's going to affect everybody, you know, in terms of food prices, in terms of political instability, trade instability, and so on. I do believe it's avoidable. I believe we can solve this problem if we farm and produce food in a much more sustainable fashion and we recycle our nutrients and we go to sustainable forms of energy for agriculture and so on. But I don't think we're focusing nearly hard enough on the problem at the moment in order to develop those solutions. So I think we're in for some nasty shocks before we actually solve the problem. However, I emphasize, I do believe it's soluble. I'm an optimist about, you know, the ability of human beings to deal with these kinds of issues.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking about a possible collapse of the global food system in the coming decades. Our guest is the well-known Australian journalist and advisor Julian Cribb. Julian, right now, the United States and Europe, and I assume Australia, are sending millions of tons of food aid to Africa and Asia. Can that continue, and what happens if it stops?
Well, you know, it's just what we call a band-aid in Australia, a sticking plaster for the problem. The issue is that Africa and the developing world need to grow their own food. We produce more than enough food for them, but at the end of the day, we're not prepared to pay to have it shipped to all of it, to have it shipped to Africa and to be distributed and, you know, all the freezer trucks and the railways and things you'd have to build to distribute food in Africa. It's much more effective if Africans grow their own food, if Indians grow their own food, if Chinese grow their own food. And that means distributing knowledge, agricultural knowledge. But at the moment, I mean, there's 1.8 billion farmers worldwide. There's an awful lot of farmers. And getting the knowledge to them is a very inefficient sort of chain at the moment. We're not focusing on that either. We're doing lots of research, well, not quite enough, but we're hardly focusing at all on the challenge of getting new knowledge, sustainable farming knowledge, into the hands of those 1.8 billion farmers. So that's an area that really needs to be tackled rather than thinking of America as a grain basket that's going to feed Africa, because frankly that's not going to happen. It hasn't happened in the last 40 years and it's probably not going to happen in the next 40.
You brought up the case of Russia that suffered a severe heat wave in the summer of 2010, and what they did was they stopped their international grain exports. Can you see that we will have in the future countries that just shut down the international food markets?
Oh, yes. I mean, if you go back to 2008, when world oil prices went to $160 a barrel and there was a crisis in rice worldwide and in other grains, countries like Vietnam and so on stopped exporting rice as well. So these kinds of things, the first thing that a government does when it gets into one of those crises is to stop exports. And that, of course, destabilizes the world market and drives up the prices even higher. So it, in fact, makes the problem even worse. And this is the difficulty we're dealing with. We're dealing with governments who have got this very, very short-term view of agriculture. They wait until there is a crisis before they do anything. They don't plan to prevent the crisis. And that's the reason I've written the book, to say there are things we can do. There are lots of things we can do, but we're not thinking about those things. We're not taking the long-term view. We're just waiting for the crisis to happen.
And during the recent drought that happened in Australia, when there was a question of whether farmers should get the water or cities should get the water, it seems like a no-brainer that the residents of the cities are going to demand their water. We can see more of that coming up in the future.
Yeah, that's because we've got very stupid governments, and they think, well, Australia's a rich country, we sell all that iron ore to China, and we can afford to buy food from overseas. But in reality, this is an agriculturally rich country, and we should be supporting our own farmers first, and we should be encouraging them to be even more water-efficient than they are. I mean, they are the world's most water-efficient farmers. They grow more food with less water than anyone else on Earth. But we need to supply them with the science and technology to help them do more of that. And by the way, that's what all farmers worldwide, in America and in everywhere, in Africa, are going to need over the coming 50, 60, 70 years as climate change hammers home. All farmers are going to be dealing with much more unpredictable climates, more droughts, more intense droughts, heavier deluges of rainfall that flood crops and things like that. So farmers are going to have to be much more flexible, and they're going to have a wider variety of crop types that they can grow to stand up to these intensifying climate hits. The area of the world's farmland is shrinking by 1% a year at current rates, and this means that by 2050, 2060, we will have less than half our current area of farmland if we don't stop this. Now, it's shrinking for two reasons. One, because it's being degraded by the economic pressures and others we're putting on our farmers. But two, it's shrinking because the cities are stealing the land from the farmers. And worldwide, by 2050, the footprint of the world's cities will occupy a land area equal to the size of China. And the footprint of those cities' recreational catchment, that's all the area they use for golf courses and recreational farms and things like that, hobby farms, that's going to occupy a land area equal to the size of the United States. And that's all on the world's best farmland, because it's all in river valleys where cities are, or coastal plains. So that's going to be subtracted from agriculture, making the whole of the agricultural system much more at risk, much more risky and unpredictable at a time when food supply is becoming more jeopardized. So we've got to think very hard before we just take up more land at the fringe of the city and turn it into urban blocks.
Oh, we see it all the time. People, farmers think, well, there's my multi-million-dollar cash, I'll sell out. And we always rule with our bylaws in favor of putting more buildings. And yes, we must have parks and walkways and all the things that we demand in the city. So I don't know how we're going to stop that. Most of the world's population is moving into these megacities.
Well, the megacities will have populations of between 7 and 8 billion by the mid-century total. And some of those cities will be 20, 30, and 40 million people in size, and they will have almost no internal food capacity. So if the trucks don't come every single night bringing more food, what will happen in one of those giant cities? If the trucks are prevented by a fuel crisis or a local war or something, you will have starvation within a week in those giant cities. And it will be a horrendous scene. It'll be like, World War II, the end of World War II, the starvation that went on in Eastern Europe. And people are not aware of that the cities no longer support themselves food-wise. So we really need to redesign our cities so that they start recycling nutrients and water and producing more of their own food.
There is a small movement here in North America, transition towns and people who are trying to get communal gardens going in the cities and looking at rooftop gardening and all of that. But it's such a tiny little fleck. As you say, if the trucks stop running, I think people would just have to walk away from the cities possibly.
Well, where would they go? Of course, you know, the farmers will be waiting there trying to stop them getting into their crops. You know, you will have mass starvation in these great megacities, and you know, there will be almost nothing we can do. So that's the kind of food shock that I think that we will see before the world really wakes up to the extent of its peril. But as I say, it's totally preventable. Growing your own veggies is a great thing to do, but it's not going to solve the problem of feeding a city. We need to have an industrialized hydroponic systems and things like that that will produce enough fruit and vegetables to help the city get by.
Here in Canada, the Canadian military historian Gwyn Dyer, he's predicted serious wars, possibly even nuclear wars, if the global food trade fails. Have you put that into your book, the possibility of struggles and wars?
Yes, indeed, I have. People have actually forgotten that you know, food, land, and water are at the root of most serious human disputes. If you peel away the superficial layers of conflict between different political groups or religious groups or ethnic groups, underneath you find people are arguing about food, land, and water. I mean, Darfur basically is a war between farmers and cowboys. Rwanda started off as an argument between cattle graziers and farmers. Eritrea and the Horn of Africa is all about agricultural failure being enmeshed with war. Even the Balkans was a fight over that. We know the Russian Revolution and the French Revolution, going further back in history, you know, both cases governments were torn down by people who were starving and angry as a result of their starvation. So we know that famine leads to war, leads to governments being torn down. And that's Gwyn Dyer's hypothesis. It's based on sound thinking by the big military think tanks in Washington and in the UK and elsewhere and in Scandinavia. They're all saying the same thing. Food, land, and water are primary drivers of conflict in this age. And if we want to avoid war, one way we can de-escalate the tensions is by ensuring that everyone is fed.
Peace through better farming. Julian Cribb, when do food shortages and famine get really serious in your view?
Well, in my view, what we're going to see is a number of shocks as we approach 2050, and each shock will be bigger than the last one if we don't take the kind of preventive actions that I'm outlining. I mean, as we say, we had the grain price shock in 2008. 2 years later, we've got a Russian drought shock. What are we going to have in 2012? I don't know, but it will be something. What is going to happen to food prices when oil prices go back to $160 or even $200 or $300 a barrel? I mean, when that happens, a lot of farmers are going to have to give up using tractors worldwide. I mean, so that's going to affect food prices directly. So it's not just climatic things that affect food prices, it's also these other scarcities. If there are scarcities in fertilizer supplies, and we've seen, you know, the Australian company BHP bidding for Canadian potash recently, well, they're not doing that because it's Be Kind to Farmers Week, they're doing that because they expect to get very rich, and they think that potash is going to be in scarce supply over the next 50 years, and they're making a bid to invest in the biggest producer in the world. So, you know, you can see that people are already speculating about these kinds of scarcities that are coming down. We need to do something about that. There are lots of things that we can do about it. I mean, in the case of potash and phosphorus, you can recycle the stuff that comes out the bottom end of cities. Instead of throwing our food in the garbage, we can recycle the nutrients. Instead of wasting our sewage effluent, we can recycle the nutrients. But we're not doing any of that at the moment, or very little of it.
And I know that in our school system, there isn't even a hint that anyone would want to become a farmer. So it seems like we need a social reorganization to appreciate where our food comes from again.
Well, two things. I think that to feed the human race in 2050, 2060, we're probably going to have to do two things. One, we're going to have to revolutionize the way we produce food in the ways that I'm outlining in the book. Secondly, we're also going to have to ask human beings to eat at a slightly lower level. That means perhaps doubling the amount of vegetables in the diet and halving the amount of meat and high protein. That would be good for us, by the way, because, I mean, our current Western diet kills a half of all consumers. You know, they're dying of heart disease, cancer, diabetes, obesity, and all of that sort of, all those different degenerative diseases. So to eat a bit lighter and to eat more vegetables would actually help them live longer and would also reduce the massive blowout in healthcare costs in every single Western country in the world. The healthcare cost is the leading budget item these days. So eating more healthily will help conserve the resource base, which grows our food worldwide. It will also make us healthier people, and it will reduce the cost burdens on our economies. So it makes sense from a number of perspectives. But how do you do that? Well, my suggestion is that we put a year of food into every junior school on the planet, in which every subject that you teach at school is taught through the lens of food. So when you study maths, you study food. When you study science, you study how plants grow and animals reproduce and things like that. When you study sport, you learn about diet and fitness and things like that. So that you're imbued with much more respect and understanding for food when you come out of your junior school year than you had when you went into it. And I think that's the only way we're going to wake people up. We're going to have something that's fairly universal. But it's easy to do. I mean, food is acceptable in all cultures and creeds.
You've brought up so many important threads there. Is there a website for your book?
Well, there's only the website at the University of California Press where the book is being marketed. I have a website called World Food Crisis, which I run mainly science stories of people who are trying to address this problem, and that's at www.sciencealert.com.au/World Food Crisis.
And give us the name of your book one more time.
It's The Coming Famine, The World Food Crisis, and What We Can Do to Avoid It.
I'll put that in my blog, so that'll make it easy for people to find. If people go to ecoshock.info and look for the blog for this radio show, you'll find a good link right there. Well, there you have it from down under, the Australian communicator and thought leader, I say, Julian Cribb. Thank you, sir. It's been an honor to have you on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Hello, I'm Alex Smith with a serious question for you. What if the past determines our future? Are we humans headed for success or lasting economic depression, perhaps on an overheated planet? Dr. Timothy Garrett is Associate Professor of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Utah. In February 2010, Tim joined us on Radio EcoShock to discuss his disturbing new scientific paper. It outlined a direct relationship between the energy we burn, the wealth we create, and the growth of greenhouse gas emissions. Now he's gone a step further with some new work. So, Dr. Tim Garrett, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I do appreciate you coming on the show, and I think we're going to learn something here today. I think we should start with your original formula for energy and wealth. Can you take a shot at explaining that for the intelligent listener?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it really started just as a simple query as to where the economic value comes from. And, you know, coming from a physics background and being really totally naive in economics, I thought, well, maybe it has something to do with the rate of energy consumption by civilization. In other words, perhaps that our wealth, the wealth of civilization, has a direct link to how much energy we can consume. To me, that seemed like a reasonable assumption, because in order for us to do anything, which I suppose is perhaps a measure of our wealth, we need to consume energy. That's a basic law of the physical universe. It is through energy transformations that anything happens. And so what I tried to do was just simply look at this using some available data, and it turned out that this relationship is in fact fixed, that there is a constant relationship of about 10 milliwatts that is required to support every inflation-adjusted $1990 of economic value. And that was the core result of the first paper I did into this. And what I tried to do was go from there to see what this implied for subjects such as global warming, which are closer to my primary field of research in atmospheric sciences.
Well, based on everything we know so far, if we grow the economy, as every politician promises, we'll put more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. But what if the economy crashes? Will we put less up there, or will we reach safe levels if we have a severe downturn?
Well, this is where my work differed slightly from perhaps what other people are thinking. Now, the way I define wealth is that it is the accumulation of our past production of economic value. So what we have today is an accumulation of what we've been able to do in the past. Now, when you talk about the economy declining, well, usually what people think about is they think about GDP going down, the gross world product declining with time. And what I showed was that if the GDP declines with time, which is ordinarily what we would think of as being a depression, this would not, in fact, correspond to lower carbon dioxide emissions. In fact, carbon dioxide emissions would need to grow. Instead, in order for carbon dioxide emissions to go down, what would be required is effectively a complete collapse of the economy. A collapse in the sense that the gross world product would have to be almost completely offset by inflation. So that, in some sense, it would seem strange to an economist to think about this, but in some sense, the global product would have to be negative rather than positive. In other words, we'd have to be in a situation of net consumption rather than net production. We are consuming more of what we have produced in the past rather than producing new, increasing wealth. So that's a rather extreme situation, but this is what the data bears out as being required to have lower carbon dioxide emissions.
So if I understand it correctly, your definition of wealth does not include the sort of fantasy money that, like the quantitative easing from the U.S. Federal Reserve, but it includes everything that humans have produced that's still here from the beginning of time. I mean, even the Pantheon in Rome would be part of our accumulated wealth at this point.
Yes. Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, I part of my wealth is my house, but the house was produced back in 1926.
And you have a new paper submitted to the journal Climatic Change, and the title is On the Coupled Evolution of Inflation, Wealth, and Atmospheric Concentrations of Carbon Dioxide. And you do go a step further here, predicting, it seems to me, almost the worst of all worlds, high levels of greenhouse gases and inflation. I still don't really get what inflation has to do with climate change.
I was actually just down in New Orleans for a scientific meeting, and I spent some time after that with my family. And we went to some local museums, and of course in New Orleans, you know, there's the lasting legacy of the Hurricane Katrina disaster. And with Katrina, as it was with, you know, perhaps all natural disasters are, historically, they've been inflationary. What they do is they destroy past production while people perhaps still have the dollars in their pockets, but there are fewer things available for their dollars to be matched to, so the cost of what is present goes up in value. I mean, as it goes up in cost. Now, this wasn't actually how I approached it in the paper, but I think this was how an economist would normally approach the topic. The way I approached it in the paper was that I showed that environmental destruction, whether it's by disease or by weather or whatever it is effectively a decay on our past production that devalues what we have, and that is effectively an inflationary pressure.
That's Dr. Tim Garrett from the University of Utah. We'll be right back as Dr. Garrett explains global warming as a recurring natural disaster, like many Hurricane Katrinas. Because it's global, there may be no outside help. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org.